This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
Hello and welcome to Reality Check. Today is Tuesday, the 1st of September 2009, and I'm your host, Tony Pittman. And this is episode 5 of Reality Check here on Joy 94.9. Reality Check is a show designed to give you a healthy dose of reality. And we do that by promoting the art of critical thinking and skeptical analysis. Each week we bring you a roundup of LGBT news, followed by an in-depth analysis of an issue related to the paranormal or the pseudoscientific. And finally, we wrap up each show with a movie review. On today's show, after our LGBT news roundup, we're going to continue our analysis of the science, or lack of it, behind the blood type diet. Then, in our movie review section, we'll review two films currently screening just about everywhere, District 9 and Inglourious Basterds. So stay tuned for all that and more here on Reality Check on Joy 94.9. Okay, here's your LGBT news for the last week or so. Our first item comes from the United States, where in just a few hours from now, in the state of Vermont, marriages between partners of the same sex will start being performed for the first time ever. Yes, today, Tuesday, the 1st of September 2009, marks the beginning of same-sex marriage in Vermont, making it the fourth state of the US to now have same-sex marriage. Actually, technically, it's the fifth state of the US to get same-sex marriage because, of course, California had same-sex marriage for a few months last year, but as we know all too well, it was cruelly taken away by a ballot initiative. So there are now currently, at this moment, three states where same-sex marriages are performed: Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Iowa, and in a few hours, Vermont will become the fourth state. Vermont actually has had civil unions for over 9 years now and was actually the first state in the US to get civil unions, and that was back in July 2000. And at this moment in time, September 2009, there are two other states of the US in which same-sex marriage laws have been passed by the legislature but are still yet to come into effect. One of those is New Hampshire, where same-sex marriage will become legal on the 1st of January 2010, so that's in 4 months from now. The other state is Maine, where a same-sex marriage bill was signed into law in May this year, but unfortunately, a very similar thing has happened there as what happened in California last year, where basically, the right-wing activists who oppose same-sex marriage look like they've amassed enough signatures to get the issue put on a ballot at elections there in November. So the state of Maine is now gearing up for a similar battle to the California one that we saw last year. So let's just hope that the result in Maine will be different from last year's California result, and that we will see a victory for marriage equality. Fingers crossed. But at least for this week, there will be much celebrating in the state of Vermont as marriage equality becomes a reality there. Now, just for your geographical knowledge, Vermont is a small state in New England, in the northeast of the United States, and in terms of population, it's actually the second smallest state in the country, with just 600,000 people. But still, it's an important victory, and it represents part of the unstoppable tide of marriage equality that is gradually sweeping across the United States and the world. Now, our second news item for today also comes from the American hemisphere, but this time from much further south, and that is from the country of Uruguay, where the lower house of the National Congress passed a bill last week to allow same-sex couples to adopt children. That bill now passes to the Senate, where it will be voted on later this month, and where it is expected to pass easily, given that the ruling party has a majority there, and it was already approved there on a first reading. Now, if and when it does come into effect, Uruguay will become the first country in Latin America to allow same-sex couples to adopt children. Uruguay actually has a pretty good recent record when it comes to LGBT rights. Actually, one of the best in Latin America, because on the 1st of January last year, 2008, it became the first country in Latin America to have a national civil union law as well. Some other jurisdictions in Latin America have had civil union laws for several years, particularly Brazil, Argentina, and Mexico come to mind. But in those countries, it's just one or two states or provinces. So Uruguay was the first country, Latin American country, to get civil unions at the national level. Also, another feather in Uruguay's cap is that just in May this year, the defense minister lifted the ban on LGBT people serving in the military. So Uruguay is surging ahead in leaps and bounds when it comes to LGBT rights, and is certainly considerably more advanced than Australia is when it comes to these issues. And don't worry, we will let you know here on Reality Check when that new same-sex adoption law is passed by the Senate and comes fully into effect. Now, dear listener, just for your information, here in Australia, adoption by same-sex couples is only permitted in Western Australia and the ACT. It is also permitted in Tasmania, but only if one member of the couple is the biological mother or father of the child. That's what they call step-parent or step-child adoption. Now, continuing on the adoption theme, let's move to Germany, where adoption by same-sex couples is also a hot topic these days, particularly last week when the Federal Constitutional Court of Germany confirmed that one member of a same-sex couple can adopt his or her partner's biological children. So this means that Germany, like in Tasmania, recognizes the right to stepchild adoption for same-sex couples, but not the right of same-sex couples to adopt children unrelated to them. There is now a push in Germany to allow full adoption rights for same-sex couples, but for the moment, the adoption right is limited just to stepchildren. Germany has had what they call registered life partnerships, which is pretty much a civil unions type of registration system, for same-sex couples since 2001. And actually, in 2004, couples in registered life partnerships got the right to stepchild adoption. So this right to adopt has been around for a while, but what happened recently was that it was challenged as unconstitutional, and a lower court actually found that it was unconstitutional. But fortunately, last week's decision of the Federal Constitutional Court overturned that lower court's decision and confirmed the right to adoption of stepchildren by a partner in a same-sex couple. So, not a new right in Germany, but one that has just been fortunately confirmed and upheld by the highest court. And in our final news item, very briefly, you probably saw that in the general election in Japan on Sunday, the Liberal Democratic Party, that is the Conservative Party that has ruled Japan almost continuously for the last 54 years, was finally thrown out of power with a landslide win by the more progressive Democratic Party of Japan. And this could, should, might, hopefully be good news for LGBT rights in Japan. LGBT activists there have expressed guarded optimism that with such a big win by the Democratic Party, there might finally be some advances in rights for LGBT people there. Because, frankly, dear listener, Japan is pretty dismal when it comes to LGBT rights. Well, at least it's not a crime to be lesbian, gay, or bi in Japan, but neither are there any laws protecting LGBT people from discrimination, nor any recognition of same-sex couples. So, LGBT people are pretty much non-existent as far as the law is concerned in Japan. So let's just hope that things do improve there pretty soon. And once again, don't worry, if there are important developments in Japan, you'll definitely hear about them here on Reality Check. All right, that's enough news for today. Let's listen to a song now, and when we come back, we're going to get into some serious skeptical analysis. Today, part three of our probing analysis of the blood type diet. So stay tuned for that after this song here on Joy 94.9.
Over 200 volunteers bring you joy every week. Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to Reality Check here on Joy 94.9. I'm Tony Pittman and the time is 20 past 1. And the song you just heard there was Africa by Toto, a classic there from 1982. Can you believe it? Quite a long time ago. All right, let's move on now to the main topic of pseudoscience for this week, and that is, once again, the so-called blood type diet, as expounded by Dr. Peter D'Adamo in his best-selling book, Eat Right for Your Type. Three episodes ago, I gave a summary of the theories behind the blood type diet, as expounded in Dr. D'Adamo's book. Then 2 weeks ago, I took a look at the question of whether his explanation of the evolution of human blood types corresponded in any way to reality. It didn't, but if you haven't heard those episodes and you want to check them out, you can download them as podcasts at joy.org.au. Just go to that site, click on the podcasts button at the top of the screen, and then click on Reality Check and you'll find previous episodes there. What I want to do today is continue the analysis of the rest of Dr. D'Adamo's theories and see if they, unlike his previous one, might be able to stand up to critical scrutiny. So, at the point where we left off last time, the theoretical basis for Dr. D'Adamo's blood type diet wasn't looking too good. Now, remember, Dr. Dodamo had based his theory on what our ideal diets should be today on what supposedly our blood type ancestors used to eat. The O's, the type O's, were the aggressive, meat-eating hunter-gatherers, while the type A's were the docile, grain-eating agrarians. And unfortunately for the good doctor, his theory crashed and burned spectacularly when we discovered that he was completely wrong in almost every possible way, even orders of magnitude wrong in the times at which the various blood types arose, which at the end of the day meant that new blood types did not arise as a result of changing diets, and in fact all four blood types have existed for over 2 million years, and all of them ate the same diets. However, the fact that Dr. Dodamo stumbled at the first hurdle doesn't mean his diet theory is pure baloney. Despite the fact that he was wrong in describing how the blood types evolved, it may still be true that blood types are important in determining your ideal diet. Maybe the next building block in his theory really does have some truth behind it. Let's take a look. Now, the subject of that next building block is lectins. Now, don't be confused by the word lectins. Lectins are just a class of proteins found in foods. And so just to remind you, Dr. Dodamo says that we should eat what our blood type ancestors ate, and the reason we should do that is because, supposedly, if you eat the wrong foods, the lectins in those foods, that is the proteins, get digested and absorbed into the bloodstream and then react chemically with your red blood cells and cause them to agglutinate, that is to form clumps, form clots in the bloodstream. Now that sounds very nasty, doesn't it? And according to the doctor, these lectins actually target organs such as the stomach, liver, kidney, and brain and start to agglutinate red blood cells in those areas. So this is not nice at all. So if you're a type O and you're supposed to be eating a lot of meat and animal protein, but then one day you eat bread made from wheat, and well, according to the doctor, you're going to get a lot of blood clots forming in your vital organs. And if you do that every day, you're going to get a lot of blood clots in all your organs. And frankly, that doesn't sound healthy at all. But how does Dr. Dodamo know all this about lectins and their agglutinating effects on different blood types? Well, he says, and I quote, "I know because the effects of lectins on different blood types are not just a theory. They're based on science. I've tested virtually all common foods for blood type reactions. I can purchase isolated lectins from foods such as peanuts, lentils, wheat or meat, and the results are visible under the microscope. I can see them agglutinating cells in the affected blood type." End quote. Well, there you go. Apparently, the good doctor knows how to do science. He has a microscope, at least. Now, I don't want to get into the question here of whether Dr. Dodamo really does know anything about science, because we'd be here for hours, if not days. And I'm not going to get into what he means by making that distinction between what he calls science and what he calls just a theory. And I'm not even going to question his methodology in any way. I'm not going to question whether his observations were double-blinded or whether he may have left himself open to a certain subjective bias. And even the question of whether observing the effect of food lectins on red blood cells on a microscope slide can have any relevance at all to what actually goes on in the bloodstream after those lectins have been digested and broken down and are under very, very different conditions. I'm not going to get into any of that. Now, somehow, I don't think that Dr. Dadama would recognize real science even if he fell over it. But let's just take him at his word for the moment. And let's stick to the exact claim that he's making. That lectins enter the bloodstream and cause clumps of red blood cells. And that different lectins affect different blood types. So let's think about that claim for a moment. Having red blood cells agglutinated in your bloodstream is not a trivial thing. It's serious and potentially life-threatening. It basically means the food that you're eating is causing irreversible blood clots to form in your circulation. Now, red blood cells have to pass through tiny capillaries throughout the body to deliver oxygen. Now, sometimes those capillaries are so narrow that the red blood cells can only pass in single file. So if major blood clots were forming throughout our body every time we ate, our capillaries would very quickly get blocked and our tissues would get damaged. And it seems to me that we probably wouldn't live very long. And as most people have not been enlightened by the good doctor and in their blind ignorance they don't follow their blood type diet, then we can assume that most people are eating agglutinating lectins several times every day. And so their bloodstream is getting filled with clumps of red blood cells. And their kidney and liver and brain and other organs are getting nasty damage done to them constantly. After every meal, in fact. So you would expect to see people getting fatal or at least debilitating conditions fairly quickly. Now let me quote here from Michael Klaper, MD, who wrote the entry on the blood type diet in Skeptic, the Skeptic's Dictionary. Dr. Klaper says, and I quote, "Such a syndrome of organ failures due to lectin-induced microinfarctions of the brain, heart, kidneys, retinas, and adrenals would be well known to pathologists and other medical scientists. It would not be a subtle disease. In the pathology texts, there would be clear descriptions, complete with photographs taken through high-power optical microscopes, as well as electron microscopes, of damage from lectin deposits and blood agglutination in most major organ systems. The existence and intricacies of such a widespread disease would be as common knowledge among physicians and cell scientists as atherosclerosis is today. Yet I am aware of no such descriptions in the pathologic literature. No pathologist I know has ever mentioned tissue infarction from lectin-induced red cell agglutination as a cause of any disease in humans." End quote. Well, how mysterious. It seems that this terrible thing that occurs when you eat the wrong foods for your blood type is only known to Dr. Dadama. He's the only one who's discovered it, and no one else has ever seen any sign of it. Maybe it's a bit like the fairies at the bottom of the garden. Well, so once again, Dr. Dadama, it looks like you are completely and spectacularly wrong. This terrible condition that you say occurs if you eat the wrong food for your blood type doesn't actually exist. Well, doesn't exist outside of the pages of your best-selling book, that is. So, at this point, it seems that all the building blocks of Dr. Dadamo's theory are falling down like a house of cards. The good doctor really doesn't have much of a leg to stand on at this stage. yet there is still hope. Okay, so maybe he didn't get the evolutionary stuff quite right. And, alright, maybe his description of the mechanism of exactly what happens when you eat the wrong foods is, well, slightly unsupported by the evidence, shall we say. But it still may be true that eating according to your blood type does keep you more healthy. I mean, the good doctor must have investigated that, right? I mean, there must be studies to show that, right? Well, stay tuned, and when we come back after this song, all will be revealed here on Reality Check on Joy 94.9.
Joy. Joy. 94.9.
This is a podcast from Joy 94.9, a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station. For more content, please go to our website at joy.org.au, or if you're in Melbourne, tune in to Joy 94.9.
You're listening to Joy 94.9. The show is Reality Check, and I'm your host, Tony Pittman. And the song you just heard there was by Katy Perry, Hot and Cold. Now, let's get back into our deep and probing analysis of Dr. Dodomo's theories. Now let's take a step back here. Let's look at what the doctor is saying. He's saying that you can be healthier, have more energy, maintain your ideal weight, etc., etc., by eating foods compatible with your blood type. So if I simply heard that claim and nothing else, I wouldn't be investigating the evolution of blood type. I wouldn't even be looking for blood clots in tissues and organs. I would be thinking, oh, okay. So I guess the doctor must have discovered some correlation here between blood type and various diet-related diseases or symptoms. Then I guess he must have done some clinical trials to prove his theory, right? I mean, he must have had various sample groups of different blood types and put them on different diets and then recorded certain objective measures of health and fitness and weight, etc., over a period of time. Or maybe he performed some large-scale, long-term population studies. I mean, they would be ideal for this type of thing. You could collect data on three things: medical history, eating habits, and blood types. And collect it from a large sample, preferably thousands of people, over a long period of time, preferably decades. Maybe that data has already been collected by health services somewhere. I don't know, in Iceland or Sweden or somewhere, and you just have to collate it all and organize it and then analyze it. And then you'd see if there is any significant correlation between blood type, what they ate, and how healthy they were, and the types of diseases they had. Right? I mean, that's what you would expect him to do with a theory like this. So, despite the lack of foundation for the other building blocks in his theory, those kinds of good quality clinical trials or large-scale population studies would be very convincing evidence that Dr. Dodomo is onto something. So I guess, loving science as he does, Dr. Dodomo would have performed those types of studies, or at least used the data from those studies performed by other people, right? Right, I mean, that's basically what he needs to prove his theory. So, I mean, he would have done that, right? Oh, I see. No, actually, no. No, he actually didn't do that type of study. And, oh, no, he doesn't refer to any studies that show that because, well, maybe because there are no studies that show that. So that's not very helpful. Oh, but wait. No, I get it. Instead of all those confusing and complicated scientific studies and all that, you know, collecting results and statistical analysis and all those confusing numbers and all that hard work, ooh, no. Dr. Dedamo has a much better way to prove his theory, and that is with his own experience with his patients. Yes, anecdotes, in other words. He just recounts all those experiences with all those patients that he met who were very ill, and when he put them on his blood type diet, they all miraculously got better. Well, there you go, Doctor. If you say so, I guess we have to believe you. I'm certainly convinced. Not. As Mark Chrislip, the presenter of the Quackcast podcast, always says, the plural of anecdote is anecdotes, not evidence. All those stories and all those case studies that Dr. Dedamo cites on page after page in his book, of all those people who apparently got much healthier by following the blood type diet, don't prove his theory in any way. They are all cherry-picked. They are all subject to the subjective bias of the doctor. And they don't include all the cases that didn't work or where nothing happened. Only a study conducted using careful scientific methodology to remove biases would begin to add any credence to Dr. Dedamo's blood type diet theory. But as far as I know, a study like that would support his theory doesn't exist. So, we have to conclude that the blood type diet expounded in Dr. Dedamo's book, Eat Right for Your Type, is a load of bunk, flim-flam, and tommy rot, and has no scientific basis whatsoever. It certainly has sold a lot of books and made a lot of money for Dr. Dedamo, but there is no reason to believe that it has any credibility at all. So, that concludes our analysis of the theory behind the blood type diet. Next week, I want to come back briefly to Dr. Dedamo and to do two things. The first is that I want to look a little bit more at the science of blood type, in that blood type is not completely benign. Your blood type actually does have a slight effect on your susceptibility to certain diseases. It's got nothing to do with diet, but certain diseases, it seems, are slightly more or less common in certain blood types. And I have to admit, I've really tried to control myself a lot in these last few episodes, and I've generally tried to treat Dr. Dedamo's claims seriously and examine them closely and critically. But the second thing I want to do next week is point out just what a douchebag Dr. Dedamo really is, how his ignorance shines through certain passages of his book in so many ways, what a painful experience it is to read his stupid book, and finally, how he is actually hurting people through what he says. So for all that, tune into Reality Check next week. And just in case you do have any questions about the blood type diet or anything else that we've covered on the show, or maybe something you'd like us to cover on the show, please do feel free to send us an email. The address here is realitychecktony@gmail.com. That's realitychecktony, T-O-N-Y, @gmail.com. All right, let's listen to one more song. And when we come back, we'll get into this week's movie reviews.
Today is a wonderful day with Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to Reality Check with me, Tony Pittman, here on Joy 94.9, also streaming live at joy.org.au. And also available as a podcast to listen to anywhere in the world on your little pod. The song you just heard there was Si Me Enamoro by Ricky e Poveri, an Italian group, Italian supergroup from the 70s and 80s. singing there actually in Spanish. One day I'd like to get the version of that song in Italian and I'll play it for you. All right, that brings us to the last segment of the show, this week's movie review. Today I'm going to talk about two films currently on general release throughout Australia, District 9 and Inglourious Basterds. First up, District 9. Well, the one thing you can say about this action movie is that the premise is certainly original. The plot of the movie is basically that 30 years ago, an alien spaceship appeared above Johannesburg. Nothing happened for a few months, and eventually the South African authorities flew up to the ship and got inside and discovered a malnourished and destitute race of aliens. In the film, they are referred to in a derogatory way as prawns, but I reckon they look more like giant upright grasshoppers. Anyway, these creatures are taken down to the ground and housed in a camp within Johannesburg that quickly turns into a filthy slum. The movie opens in the present day when a corporate military contractor has been charged with relocating the 1.8 million aliens to a new camp, District 10, at 240 kilometres from Johannesburg. So the film follows an Afrikaner employee of this military company, Vikas, as he heads into District 9 to serve eviction notices on the prawns. Needless to say, things don't go as smoothly as intended, and the plot and action develop from there. So, the two most refreshing things about this movie are the highly original premise, and also the fact that it's a South African production, shot almost entirely on location in Johannesburg, something that we almost never get to see on the big screen. And although the general narrative arc of the movie is, well, it follows a pretty standard formula for an action flick where, you know, the hero has to try to achieve his goal, but obstacles keep appearing in his path and things just get progressively worse until everything seems hopeless just before we get to the big climax. I mean, we've all seen this formula about a million times. Still, I did find that the details of what was going on in the story were pretty original and pretty unpredictable, and they kept me engrossed in the film. The other interesting element of this movie is that it draws a very obvious parallel between the treatment of the aliens and the treatment of black people during the apartheid regime in South Africa. The way the aliens are treated by the human authorities, the way humans refer to them, and how they want to live segregated, how they want them to live segregated from the humans, away from the humans, are very obvious allusions to the bad old days of apartheid. So it's interesting to find, it's refreshing to find a social and political conscience in an action movie like this. The other interesting thing about this movie is that they spend about the last 4 or 5 minutes of the film actually pretty much just setting up the premise for a sequel. So I wouldn't mind betting that within the next 2 or 3 years, we'll probably be seeing District 10 coming to our local screens. So I did enjoy this movie, District 9. I found it entertaining and fun. I mean, it is a funny movie in quite a lot of parts. Nothing profound, but it's a well-done and original action film. I did have two small criticisms of the film, though. The first is that in pretty much in the second half of the movie, the story veers a bit too much into pure action, and that does get a little bit tiresome, especially as most of the action involves very loud machine gun fights. So the sheer noise of the fighting does get a little bit tedious. So I would have preferred a bit more plot and intrigue in that part of the movie rather than just shoot 'em ups. My other criticism is that for a film that is obviously so politically and socially aware, I felt that, ironically, the movie itself is guilty of a certain degree of racism. And one way is because all the main characters in the film are white. The lead character and his wife and all his family and most of his colleagues, not all of them, but most of them, along with all the main bad guys who are the kind of corporate soldier squad, and also the main talking head journalists who are coming in to narrate the backstory, all of them are white. So to me, this is the same kind of subtle racism, more like racism in casting choices for the movie, that I find very frustrating in most American movies. And I mean, it's kind of based on the premise that supposedly white American audiences, who are the biggest audience for most movies these days, white American audiences supposedly can only relate to a white hero like them, supposedly. So I have to say that I was quite disappointed to see that same element in a South African film, particularly one that is indirectly about the evils of apartheid. But the thing that annoyed me most in this movie was the way it portrays Nigerians. In the film, there are Nigerian gangs that live in District 9 and run various rackets, trading in arms and ripping off the aliens by selling them cat food at exorbitant prices. And all the Nigerians in the film are portrayed as bad guys. I found this very frustrating in a movie whose implicit message is about not stereotyping people and not judging people by external factors or groups they belong to. It's very disappointing to see that it then turns around and perpetuates the worst kind of stereotypes about Nigerians. Not one single Nigerian character was portrayed in a positive light. That I found very disappointing. Anyway, that said, I did enjoy District 9, and it's certainly refreshing to see something this new and this original on the big screen. So I can recommend checking it out. And the other film I can also highly recommend checking out is Inglourious Basterds, the latest much-hyped movie from Quentin Tarantino. Now, I have to say I went along to this film with a certain degree of trepidation. I really didn't enjoy the last few films that Tarantino has done. And so when I went along to Inglourious Basterds, I was expecting to be disappointed. But fortunately, I was gripped and engrossed throughout the whole movie and enjoyed it. A very nice surprise, I must say. Now, I suspect that most people have probably heard something about the basic plot of this film. It's been talked about pretty much everywhere. And so that is that it's about a squad of eight Jews led by Brad Pitt who go behind enemy lines during World War II to kill as many Nazis as they can. But actually, that's not really the main story of the film. It's kind of the minor part of two interconnecting stories that eventually come together in a plot to kill off most of the Nazi leadership. And the movie becomes quite unpredictable and therefore, in my opinion, interesting. I love movies where you don't know what's going to happen and where at any moment it's completely unpredictable what events might occur or which direction the movie might take. So I don't want to reveal too much about the plot, but because I really think it's better to watch this movie with very little knowledge of what's going to happen. But one thing I really enjoyed in this film was those very Tarantino-esque elements that we've seen in pretty much all of his films, and that is the two or three really long scenes where you just have a long, sometimes seemingly pointless conversation between several characters. That's kind of a trademark of Tarantino. And in some of his other movies, I haven't found these scenes very effective. I've found them a bit tedious. But in this movie, Inglourious Basterds, I found them really effective and engrossing, especially because, well, they work really well because they build up the tension over a long period of time. And because you really don't know what's going to happen, but you suspect that things are probably going to go horribly wrong, so you're just waiting on tenterhooks. And I really enjoyed that feeling of long, drawn-out suspense. And I think it's something that Tarantino does really well in this movie. The only objection that I had to Inglourious Basterds, and a bit like in District 9, it's a bit more about the implicit message within the story rather than anything technical about the film. And that is the idea that killing and torturing German soldiers is an acceptable thing to do. Brad Pitt's squad is set up with the goal of killing as many Nazis as they can. But what troubles me is that not only do they assume that every German soldier is a Nazi, which is not necessarily true, but there's also kind of an implicit assumption that it's okay to torture and brutalize and kill German soldiers any way you want. The idea is somehow that Nazis are so bad and so evil that it's acceptable to do anything we want to them. And there's even one very graphic scene in the movie where a German prisoner is clubbed to death with a baseball bat by one of the Jews, just because he's supposedly a Nazi. And the scene is not portrayed in a critical way. It's almost, in fact, comical. And, okay, yeah, I know that this is just a movie and it's a Quentin Tarantino movie and it's a revenge fantasy and all of that, and it's pure fiction and I shouldn't get too upset by it. But still, the implicit message troubled me. Firstly, because it involves judging an individual person based on certain beliefs about the group to which he or she supposedly belongs, when you actually don't know anything about that particular individual. And secondly, because, well, I know it sounds trite to say it, but Nazis are human beings too. And human rights apply to everyone, and there are humanitarian laws, and there are laws of war, and they do have a moral reasoning behind them. And if you torture and murder someone just because you think they're a bad person, well, in my opinion, that makes you just as bad as they are, or as you think they are. Anyway, I'm not going to get into a moral or philosophical argument here, but I'll just say that little implicit assumption within the story of the film did leave me feeling a little bit uneasy. But that criticism aside, I found Inglourious Basterds to be a very engrossing and compelling movie, and I highly recommend it. Just please don't follow the moral example that it sets. That's all. And that brings us to the end of the fifth episode of Reality Check here on Joy 94.9. I hope you enjoyed the show. Remember to send any questions, comments or feedback to realitychecktony@gmail.com. And remember to tune in at 1 o'clock next Tuesday for episode 6. All right, have a great week, everyone. See you next week.
This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.